Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Thousands of Turkish lawyers walked out of their courthouses today, protesting the detainment of lawyers last night in that battle between police and protesters. These now nearly two-week-long protests were launched by environmentalists trying to save a park. They've escalated into a crusade against Prime Minister Erdogan, who's still popular with more conservative rural Turks. But there was reportedly a meeting today between Erdogan and protesters. Sebnem Arsu, Turkey correspondent for The New York Times, is on the line from Taksim Square. Sebnem, there was some debate as to who would be at the meeting. Who went?
We have a director, a film director. We have students. We have academics. We have writers. So 11 people that have not been part of Taksim Solidarity, which is an umbrella group that represented the organizers of the protest from day one, but they seem to be just individual activists that the government picked. Among them, for example, there's also a former party supporter who put up a really emotional letter up on social networks saying why he no longer supports the government.
Well, let's pick up with that. So this is, a party supporter, you're referring to Prime Minister Erdogan's party, who's now expressing dismay with him. How is that resonating?
Well, the letter was received very positively among the protesters, and it was one token in their hands to show that it was not only marginal group, it was not only liberals, but actually his own people that were not happy.
You mentioned the people who were in the room and that none of them were with the Taksim Solidarity Group. This is the name of the umbrella group of protesters. And this has made a lot of protesters angry. Here's a tweet from one Turkish journalist. Turkey's PM Erdogan meets with fake representatives of hashtag Occupy Gezi. That's the park where this all started. So how are protesters feeling about the fact that the prime minister is meeting with perhaps celebrities, artists, authors, angry members of his own party, but not protesters?
When you walk around the park or the square and talk to people and ask whether they've been following these exchanges of statements or meetings with people, they couldn't care less. I mean, they have very simple expectation from the prime minister at this stage, and that is for him to quit the idea of reconstructing, rebuilding this, Ottoman era replica of military barracks called Topçu Kışlası.
We've spoken to protesters who think that this building that the prime minister wants to do is metaphor for how he's running roughshod over some of their democratic ideals. But we know that Erdogan's supporters, and there are a lot of them, are saying he was democratically elected. He's still, in their eyes, a moderate leader. Where do you see this going?
Many people here expect Tayyip Erdogan to take the message. And, certain academics that have been following the party politics say that if we hadn't had only 7 months ahead of local elections, Mr. Erdogan could have picked a much tolerant line. But now that we have local elections ahead, Erdogan is trying to solidify its conservative constituency. So many people see his tough stance as part of his election campaigning policy.
Yeah. And by the way, you said that some people still in the square, the protesters, didn't care what was going on in this meeting, but they may also not be hearing about it because we're hearing anecdotally that state TV is not covering a lot of this. The major networks only offering sporadic coverage. Because of what? They might be fined?
It's not that. I mean, there has been a very strong sense of self-censorship in Turkish media in recent years for several reasons. And it was considered to be unacceptable by many people here. And that's also why they say more people took the streets and protested because they felt completely alone and excluded. And when media did not even, paid attention to what they were thinking, so they had to be in the street and make their voices heard.
Well, but why would the media self-censor? Is it because of a fear of the government?
Pretty much. And we've seen a prime minister openly, publicly warning media patrons in Turkey, asking certain columnists who were critical of government policies to be dismissed. And we've seen these columnists losing their jobs. We've seen a lot of news programs on TV disappearing suddenly. So all of this created an air of self-censorship.
Sebnem Arsu, Turkey correspondent for The New York Times, reporting from Taksim Square in Istanbul. Sebnem, thank you.
Thank you.
Jenny Boylan's out with a new book. In 2003, her best-selling memoir, She's Not There, chronicled her transition from a man, James Finney Boylan, to a woman, Jennifer Finney Boylan, through gender reassignment surgery. It told of the impact on the Boylan marriage, how Deirdre Boylan decided to stay in that marriage even as her husband transitioned to a woman. With their two boys, they settled back in Maine, and readers wondered, what happened next? Well, now, 10 years later, Jenny answers that question in an updated version of the 2003 book and also in a new memoir, Stuck in the Middle with You. And in it, she also raises some questions. How will her two sons turn out with a mother and a former daddy? What does it mean to be a parent, a father? She also includes conversations with other writers, including her good friend Richard Russo, Augustine Burroughs, and Anne Beattie. The result is an in-depth look at the nature of parenting itself. What better conversation to have as we approach Father's Day? Or as Jenny Boylan, what is it called in your house? It's not Father's Day.
We call it Maddie's Day.
Maddie's Day. Maddie is the name one of your children came up for you?
Yeah, and that's as good a place to start as any. When they were about 6 years old and my older son, Zach, turned to me and said, we can't be calling you Daddy if you're a girl. That's too weird. And I said, what do you want to call me? And he said, well, how about Maddie? Because that's like half mommy and half daddy. And then his little brother quickly piped up and said, or Dommy. Well, Dommy didn't stay, but Maddie did.
Well, happy Maddie's Day upcoming to you. You're joining us from the studios of Colby College up in Maine, where you're also a professor of English. And by your side, as she has been, Deirdre Boylan, your wife. Deirdre, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
How do you feel about Maddie's Day approaching?
Oh, well, we have a triumvirate of holidays in June that include our anniversary, Jenny's birthday, and Maddie's Day. So
yeah, we call
it's
it
really
Holy Week.
Holy Week in our house.
Well, Deirdre, how does this work? How have you settled into this relationship with a woman who was once a man that you loved? How does the whole parenting thing work?
Interestingly enough, I don't think our parenting really changed much. I was always the one who would have to teach them how to throw a football anyway, and I was the soccer coach. And so, truthfully, one of the things that we've realized is that our parenting is not very gendered to begin with.
Yeah, I think that the one thing we've learned is that the gender of the parents probably matters less than the love that's in the family.
Well, you write that as parents went, you were a rather feminine father, and that, for that matter, perhaps you're a masculine mother. What do you mean by that?
We have to separate what we mean by masculine and feminine from what we associate with maleness and femaleness. I am unambiguously female now, but there are certainly many things about me that are still masculine. But
they still watch the Three Stooges and the Marx Brothers together.
There you go.
But I think that that's true of lots of women and lots of moms.
Well, but still, you have this incredible vantage point. As you say, having been a father for 6 years and a mother for 10. You're sort of a mashup. What do you call it?
There is a time in between when I was the parental equivalent of the schnoodle or the cockapoo.
But tell us more about what we learned from that.
I think when I first began the transition, I was expecting that on the other side of gender, I would find a whole different personality, a whole different character. And there are some things about me that are different now, but overwhelmingly, my character is the same.
You know, when you ask about how do you stay in a marriage with someone who has changed so much, it's really important to remember, for me anyway, the most fundamental aspects of Jenny haven't changed. Now, approaching our 25th wedding anniversary, I'm still married to the person that I fell in love with.
If there's anything that is different about me now, I think I'm a little bit less goofy as the mother that I am now than when I was a father. I remember there was a day when I lay the children down on the floor and coated their feet with peanut butter so that the dogs would lick it off, which would make them the boys, that is, laugh at the top of their lungs. I don't think I do stuff like that quite so much anymore. You know, I don't put the spray cheese on the dog's head quite so often anymore. I think as a mother, I'm a little bit more cautious. I think I worry about them more. I think I keep after them a little bit more. But it may also simply be that as a mother, I'm the parent of teenagers. I will say that the main difference between the before and after in my life is that it's really not the difference in going from male to female. It's the difference between someone who had a pretty powerful secret to someone who really doesn't have that many secrets anymore.
But Deirdre, were there times when you almost wanted to fall back on cultural expectations? Say to Jenny, wait a minute, if you're going to be the woman, then I want you to do more of this. Or,
think actually, perhaps more accurately, is there are still a few household tasks that I insist she do because the man used to do those, and I'm not gonna. And it's nothing serious, but it's like mowing the lawn and calling the guy. Are the male tasks.
Explain what you mean by calling the guy.
Well, that's because we don't know how to fix anything in our house, neither of us. And so if something needs to be fixed, we have to call a guy.
I changed the light bulbs, can I just say?
But that's because you're the tallest.
I am tall.
I think, Jenny, you also said that you felt that Deirdre had lost so much. In other words, this sense of what she thought was true in your passage, that she shouldn't have to lose mowing as well.
Well,
I do pretty much have a trump card. I can get her to do almost anything.
Guilt. It's a great guilt.
Because she feels so guilty.
You know, it's funny. I think I bear more guilt about, it's really been half of our marriage now. We've been about 12 years on either side of the gender divide. And I think that I still bear more guilt at this hour for having changed the contract of our marriage than I think Dee Dee has any, you know, resentment about. I think it's really, at this point in time, it's really more my issue than hers.
I think that that's true. There were times a long time ago that I did feel very gypped and very scared and didn't know how I would move forward in or out of the marriage. But it seems like a very long time ago to me.
But you know, there really was a thing that when I came out, a thing that people would frequently say to me was, well, I guess it's okay for you to change your gender, but the person I feel sorry for is your wife. Or what about those poor children? Mm-hmm. And here we are 10 years later, and both of our sons are thriving. I mean, they're not perfect children. We're not perfect parents. But certainly having me as a parent has done them no harm. And I think you could make the case that it has done them a fair amount of good as well. And there are times when I very smugly want to show off my boys and tell people, look at these boys, look at this family, and tell me what is the problem.
That's Jenny Finney Boylan. We were also speaking with her wife, Deirdre. By the way, we didn't ask Deirdre why she stayed in the marriage. It's obvious reading the book. She loves Jenny. But what about those kids? Ahead of Father's Day, we are looking at a transgendered parent. What happens in a family? More in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. We're going to pick up our conversation with Jenny and Deirdre Boylan. They're talking about their married life after Jenny's transition from male to female. But we're also watching the news. So briefly, weather forecasters are warning that a massive line of thunderstorms could spawn a derecho. That's a storm with winds spanning 240 miles from the Midwest to the Mid-Atlantic coast. So it heads up there. Also, 10-year-old Sarah Murhanan, who has cystic fibrosis and was behind that lawsuit that sparked a debate over how organs are donated, is getting a lung transplant today, according to her family. We will follow that story for you as well. But we want to pick up our conversation with Jenny and Deirdre Boylan. Jenny writes about their marriage post her transition from male to female in her new book, Stuck in the Middle with You, a memoir of parenting in three genders. And, you know, Jenny, Deirdre, people curious about your personal life. As you know, you're very upfront about that. You call yourself quasbians, somewhat like lesbians who do not have sexual relations. And you say most people are comfortable with whatever decisions you make as adults, but let's talk more about your parenting. That people express concerns about the kids, your sons, Zach and Sean. You had a lot of concern about this, and there was a time, Deirdre, when you were both viewing your sons through the prism of gender reassignment. Sean, for instance, had a very traumatic time in elementary school. Tell us about that.
There was a period in fourth grade when he really didn't want to get out of bed.
So Sean went through this
sad period.
Time, and of course I was immediately thinking, it's because of me. And later he said, well, actually, I didn't like my math teacher that year.
He went to a counselor. He went to a school counselor.
And why would it have anything to do with you?
He did, actually.
But still, what about your concerns as to how you parent them? Because the book starts, you're sitting watching Zach in a fencing match, and you're saying, you know, sometimes parents look at their kids as cosmic mulligans, a chance to get it right, and you looked at Zach as a much better, more successful version of yourself as a man. Do you ever find yourself thinking, gosh, am I not giving my sons in particular something only a man could have given them?
I do worry about that sometimes, in the same way that you worry about probably virtually everything you could think of. If there's something you could worry about with your children, then I think parents will worry about it. But I don't think there's anything that I could have given them as a man that I haven't been able to give them as a woman. I would argue, in fact, that what my boys have gotten as a result of having me as a parent is much greater than any loss. What they've gotten is a sense of compassion, a sense of understanding of the profound choices that people, parents and children, sometimes have to make, and to know that you can make those decisions, you can be brave and survive in the world. I think they have a little bit more sympathy for the underdog in the world. And I think it's made them more thoughtful and emotional. You know, Dee Dee and I joke sometimes that of the couples that we knew 25 years ago that were getting married, there's one other couple, other than Dee Dee and I, who are still married. The rest of them all got divorced. So in some ways, we want to say, if you want your marriage to last, gentlemen, you know what you got to do.
Sex change.
Right. Ready, go.
Oh, wait. No.
Just kidding.
You're talking about honesty. You know, remove the secret, whatever it might be.
Right. And sharing a vision of what you want your family to be and being able to work on that together.
And accept change. I don't care what gender you are. After 25 years, you are not going to be married to the same person that you married when you began. And you shouldn't be. With any luck, over the course of a long, long life, you will watch your spouse turn into a person you could never have imagined, for better and for ill. And, you know, we meant it when we said for better or worse.
Well, and, you know, with that, I think it's important to say I don't recommend that people stay in bad marriages because they're married. But I think what we have found is that our life is really sustaining to us. What we share and work on together is far more important than the things that have risen up as obstacles.
It's probably worth mentioning that although people might think that Dee Dee and I are an outlandish couple, the National Center for Transgender Equality now reports that about 50% of couples who go through what Dee Dee and I went through now stay together. And not just in terms of gender, but in terms of all the changes that people go through and the different kinds of families that there are. The world is full of different kinds of families. Fewer than 10% of American families now consist of a mother and a father and children in which only the father works. So in some ways, the biggest outliers in American civilization now today are not transgender couples or same-sex couples or single moms or dads, but the so-called traditional American family itself. We have come to accept and embrace and celebrate the great variety of the different ways there are of being human.
And by the way, I want to jump in and say that, of course, single women have handily raised
right.
children, and single men, fathers have, and you talk
right.
to many of them in your book. But a lot of the questions that you posed after being introspective about your own choices, but also talking to friends, Augustine Burroughs, Richard Russo, Edward Albee, about what exactly is a father. You wrote, what is a father? What do you really take away from your sons? You took away the ability for them to call you dad. sounds like you raised a lot of questions, but you feel comfortable with the answers.
When you talk to other parents about their experiences as parents and as when they were children, you learn how many different ways there are to have a family and how many different ways there are to succeed.
That's Jenny Finney Boylan, author of Stuck in the Middle with You, a memoir of parenting in three genders, male, female, and was it that middle one, the schnoodle?
The schnoodle.
The schnoodle, yeah.
When she was transitioning from male to female. We're also speaking with Jenny's wife, Deirdre. I want to wish you both a happy Maddie's Day coming up on Sunday.
Thank you. Happy Maddie's Day to you, too.
Thank you.
Again, Maddie's Day, what they call Father's Day coming up, a combo of mother and father, mother and daddy. So a provocative conversation for many. I'm sure it stirred up some thoughts, and we want to hear them. You can do that at hereandnow.org. Leave a comment. And by the way, while there, tell us what's in your night table book tower. There's a picture of mine. Jenny's book is there. Only 30 more to go. If it falls, I'm a goner. But let us hear from you. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The ICA with Barry McGee. Vibrant paintings and installations capture the energy of the street in this 20-year retrospective on view now. ICABoston.org. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Where's Edward? Edward Snowden, the 29-year-old who leaked the news of the NSA's two surveillance programs, phone and internet, is reportedly still in Hong Kong and reaching out to human rights lawyers. What are they telling him? James Pomfret of Reuters is also in Hong Kong. He's also been talking to lawyers to find out what defense Snowden might be planning. But James, first, what is the latest there in Hong Kong?
The latest is the South China Morning Post newspaper here in Hong Kong. They just published an exclusive interview with Snowden himself, and that was conducted recently. So he's still in Hong Kong, but his location is still a mystery to most people. Hong Kong really is a small place, and it's not easy for an individual of such prominence like Snowden just to vanish or disappear. So, I mean, it seems to me that there would be some patrons or benefactors in Hong Kong that are perhaps putting him up in their homes. And he would be wise to prepare as best he could for a formal extradition request by the U.S. Legal sources here have been telling us that, yes, he has been approaching several prominent lawyers here in Hong Kong. And given the city's pretty robust and independent judicial system, this could be as good a place as any to try and fight his legal battle.
Yeah. You're saying that he could form a defense that he didn't harm anyone and that he's seeking political asylum. But meanwhile, Hong Kong has an extradition treaty with the U.S., but it's still ruled by China, although somewhat autonomous. So what would have to happen for extradition to happen?
Basically, the American authorities would have to approach the Hong Kong government through diplomatic channels, or it would have to issue some kind of warrant for his arrest through Interpol. But one key aspect is that Hong Kong authorities must also charge him with an equivalent crime in Hong Kong before he can be formally arrested. Otherwise, he's pretty much free to roam in the city. He's presumed innocent until charges are laid against him. So he's pretty much free to do as he wishes. Hmm. And the lawyer told us today that, strictly speaking from a legal perspective, he could leave Hong Kong if he so chose to do.
Yeah. Although if Hong Kong does decide to cooperate with the U.S. request for extradition, one of the laws in the treaty they could cite and charge him with is unlawful use of computers. Meanwhile, the lawyers you spoke with speculated about where he might go if he decides to leave, and most of them say he should leave quickly before the United States decides what it's going to do. But one recommendation was New Zealand, as you write, where he could join Kim.com. You remind us that Kim.com was the founder of a file-sharing site who is fighting extradition.
Yeah, the world may be for fugitives like Snowden, is not such a large place after all. If you look at all the potential places where he might get some kind of sympathetic support from governments, it's not such a long list, particularly when they might have to go up against, you know, the most powerful governments on Earth, the U.S. But New Zealand was one place that was cited. Russia was another place. And a batch of Scandinavian countries, not just Iceland, which is Snowden's preferred choice, but also Sweden or Norway. But all in all, there are direct flights to many of these countries, New Zealand and Scandinavian countries, but there isn't actually a direct flight to Iceland or Ecuador, which is where the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is trying to seek refuge in.
Because we're reminded that Iceland even has a pirate party in politics, which supports this kind of online release of information. James Pomfret, Reuters correspondent in Hong Kong on the, you know, the new version of Where's Waldo, Where's Edward. James, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And by the way, the South China Morning Post is now saying that Edward Snowden says he won't leave Hong Kong, but will use the city as a base. We'll keep an eye on this story. And as we head to break, a challenge. The Boston Bruins and Chicago Blackhawks face off tonight in Game 1 in the Stanley Cup Finals. Listener David Stromberg in Chicago says Hawks in 6. David, I say Bruins in 7 after they give us a hat attack, and I'm putting a lobster on it. You, David? Back in 30 seconds, here and now. It's here and now. Iran will hold a presidential election on Friday. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad can't run again because of term limits. There are 6 candidates vying to replace him. When the dust settles, Iran is expected to be as repressive as it is now. When I say the name Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, that may be all many people know about Iran, because all we seem to hear about is the politics. But our new co-host, Jeremy Hobson, is here with a story that underscores there is much, much more. Jeremy, what have you got?
There's so much more, Robin, when it comes to Persian culture. And I visited a Persian restaurant here in Boston called Lala Roque.
Know it well.
And it is run by an Iranian family who visits the country frequently, comes back with things. I stopped by for a chat and started by having a cup of traditional Persian tea with the chef owner, Azita Bina Saibal.
Well, we don't use tea bags. We boil the water. Then you put the tea and you steam it. That's boiled. And as a tradition, technically, they have the tea samovar going all day in the house.
So it's always tea time in Iran.
You just keep drinking tea. It's like you have so much tea in your blood that it's like you're turning into tea. And we've tried to mimic it here because obviously we can't get it here. So we blend it. We blend 4 different teas to get the tea that comes close to it, not quite, but I think it's the closest to what we have there.
The tea was hot, though she says not as hot as they serve it in Iran. We sat down at one of the tables, and I asked her why she opened Lala Roque.
Well, I originally had an Italian restaurant until I met my husband. Him coming into the family, having my mother's cooking, he kept saying, you have to open a Persian restaurant. You have to open a Persian restaurant. People don't know about this food. You will do fantastic. You have to introduce this food to people. And I was hesitant because all the Persian restaurants at the time, they were closing. We had the revolution that they were, some were harassed.
You needed people to be ready for it.
I needed people that knew about it, that had the experience. I think there was some kind of unease between Persians and Americans. Some. There were a lot of students in other parts of the country that had a very difficult time during the revolution in this country. When we opened, we just wanted to tell people, look, just because of what's happening now with the hostage situation, with the political issues, this country has had history of culture, history of food, art, poetry. So we wanted to bring that out to people. Between choosing the name,
which is based on a poem,
which is based on an Irish poet, Sir Thomas More.
How has business been over the years? I mean, have you had to deal with the ups and downs based on the politics that are going on at the moment?
I'd like to believe that politics has not affected us. But there have been times when our president from Iran has made statements that were not kind towards the West. Maybe for a few days it has affected us.
Really? People didn't come in because of that?
I'd like to believe not. That would have nothing to do with it. But I think in subconscious, maybe.
Now, your mother has clearly passed on her recipes and the things that she knows how to cook to you. Do you feel a responsibility to do that, to keep that tradition going?
I do, and I think I'm passing it on. We've fed more people than my mother has ever fed in her life to people who don't know our food, and we're proud of that. We've introduced people to not only Persian food, but to my mother's cooking. You really literally have to be in my mother's house to be able to eat this recipe.
Now, your mother brings spices back with her when she comes back, right?
The whole suitcase. This time I sell two suitcases, and she's got two more coming. It's, in fact, in the trunk of my car right now.
So there's something going on with those spices that you can get there that you just can't find here.
Oh, you can find them here. It's not that you can't find. You can find cumin here.
But they're not the same.
It's not the same.
So you just got back from Iran, but for most people, that's not something they've experienced. What's it like there right now?
There are people in the street. There are cars in the street. There's bicycles in the street. There are motorcycles in the street. There are people on the sidewalk. There's a lot of traffic during traffic time. And I have to say, you know, for a country, for people that economic, political stress, and they still take the time to spend with the family, to enjoy the day with the family, picnicking, having lunches, afternoon snacks along the riverbeds.
You're talking all about the culture. Do you think that that's getting lost, as the conversation, at least over here, is always about the politics?
Look at other countries. When it comes to news, you're always telling who blew who up, who killed who. You never talk about culture, because I guess the news don't consider that as news.
But here you are, an ambassador of Persian culture.
We've tried. And I'm even more energized now after not being there for 5 years and listening to the news here, listening to the miseries. I decided not to go because I was so sad.
Sorry, it's difficult to even think about it.
Yeah, because it was sad 5 years ago when I went. I felt guilty for living the way I do here and seeing the people there. And now I see, well, they've adapted. they're living, and they're successful. And yes, they're struggling, so we are here. I felt energized on this trip. I met young people that were born during revolution. I met artists that, even though they're saying, okay, yes, we are suppressed, we're dark, but then in their art they have colors. 5 years ago I didn't see that in their pictures.
When you're here every day serving Persian food in the United States, are you thinking of your friends, your family back home?
I'm always thinking of family and friends, and more so this time.
Well, Azita Bina Seibel, chef owner here at La La Roque in Boston, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
And Azita was speaking with our new co-host, Jeremy Hobson. A tender conversation and warming up the chair, because we're going to see a lot more of you next week.
We will. And by the way, Robin, we've got pictures of Azita's most recent visit to Iran at our website, hereandnow.org.
Terrific. And we should mention, her restaurant, La La Roque, is an underwriter of our mother station, WBUR. We're going to be back. Here it comes, our graduation season ritual. Jeremy, you will love this in 1 minute, here and now. It's here and now, and it's graduation time, so you might want to gather around the radio for our annual ritual, a song that was written and first recorded by Canadian star Murray McLaughlin, then a hit for folk icon Tom Rush in 1970, when parents and children were fighting over war.
Goodbye, Mama. Goodbye to you, too.
It's actually called Child Song. In it, someone's child is moving on. It kills. But what does it mean to the man who made it famous? We asked Tom Rush what he thought when he first heard it.
Well, I think pretty much the same thing you did, Robin. It's just one of those songs that knocks you over. I remember clearly I was rehearsing my trio in Toronto, and my lead guitar player was a fellow named Trevor Veach, and he said, my friend Murray's coming over. He's got a couple of songs you might like. And Murray showed up, and we sat around the edge of the stage, and he played the Child Song, and it was just, you know, bowled me over. I knew that I had to sing it, but I couldn't get through it from top to bottom for about 6 months. I had to toughen up enough that I didn't burst into tears.
Why?
Somewhere around the third verse.
Right. What did it do for you? What was it getting at in you?
Well, it's just that it's such a true song. I mean, it's so simple, but it's not an easy song to record. The recording that I did for Columbia, what you hear there is, I believe, take 96. It wouldn't sound like it should. It wouldn't sound true. And we finally got David Bromberg to play guitar with me as I sang it. And that elicited the performance that we were after for me. We took Bromberg off.
Oh, so having him play helped you sing.
It did.
Well, we read that Murray McLaughlin wrote it in the late 60s when he would have been a teen. It was literally his letter to his own parents when he left home.
There ain't no use in shedding no more tears, Mom. There ain't no use in shouting at me, Pa. I can't live no longer with your fears, Mom. I love you, but that hasn't helped at all.
For me, it's one of those songs, you know, Joni's Urge for Going will be a great song as long as winter comes. Mm-hmm. And I think Child Song will be a great song as long as kids grow up and leave home.
You're referring to another Canadian, Joni Mitchell there.
Yeah.
The song also reflects on age. The young man kind of saying, I'm sorry to his mom if you're feeling older, but I am too.
I know how hard it is not to be young. You've tried to keep me from the cold.
And I'm wondering, Tom Rush, you sang this song as a young man. You sing this song as a parent.
It works. And I think it also works as a child of parents who are growing older and leaving us forever.
How many years have you sung this song?
Well, since 1970, you'll have to do the math, but a lot of years, but I still love it. I still do it in my shows.
Oh, really?
It's one of my favorite songs of all time.
You don't get sick of it because you tour a lot.
I think it has a lot of resonance for parents, you know, as well as for kids.
Especially this time of year.
Yes.
Well, I have to ask you, you've got the guitar. Can you do Child Song for us?
I can, and I will. Goodbye, Mama, and goodbye to you too, Pa. Little sister, you'll have to wait a while to come along. And goodbye to this house and all its memories. We just got too old to say we're wrong. And I've got to make one last trip to my bedroom. Guess I'll have to leave some stuff behind. It's funny how the same old crooked pictures, they just don't seem the same to me tonight. There ain't no use in shedding no more tears, Mom. There ain't no use in shouting at me, Pa. And I can't live no longer with your fears, Ma. I love you, but that hasn't helped at all. Cause each of us must do the things that matter. And all of us must see what we can see. Though it was long ago, you must remember, you were once as young and scared as me. And I don't know how hard it is yet, Mama, when you realize you're growing old. I know how hard it is now to be younger. And I know you've tried to keep me from the cold. And thanks for all you've done, it may sound hollow. Thank you for the good times that we've known. But I must find my own road now to follow. You will all be welcome in my home. I've got my suitcase, I must go now. I don't mind about the things you said. I'm sorry, Ma, I don't know where I'm going. Remember, little sister, look ahead. And tomorrow I'll be in some of the sunrise. Maybe I'll have someone at my side. Mama, give your love back to your husband. And Father, you have taught me well. Goodbye. And goodbye, Mama. And goodbye to you too, Pa.
Say thank you, but you've killed me.
Aww. Oh. It's one of those songs.
Yeah. Tom Rush with his cover of Canadian singer-songwriter Murray McLaughlin's Child Song. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see if I make it. With your indulgence, they wait all year. A shout-out to grads at our home station, WBUR. With graduate degrees, Meghna Chakravarti, Kurt Nickish, Doug Trabu, Kate Duggan, Corey Lewis, Marika Van Dam, Wilder Fleming, Sarah Dietz, Nancy Hagener, and Christy Panduku. Our college grads are Sarah Brooks, Hannah Gale, Tristan Foley, Laura Grosak, Jonathan Hatch, and Jack Naren. High school grads, Jackie Andriano, Lauren Elizabeth Handy Brown, Charlotte Carr, Joe Gale, Ethan LeClaire, Paige Merrill, and Merrick Sund. And I'll be traveling to the Owen J. Roberts High School graduation of Amberlina Brianna Dwyer, Can't Believe It Ams. Fly away all. Don't forget to tell us what you see. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm going to make this. Join us again.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.